Started that, right? Okay, good. All right, today we're continuing on our barreling along quickly path in history because there's way too much to cover in the next 3 weeks. I'm supposed to get to the 1600s. We'll see if we get there. But today we're going to attempt to do closing of the Talmud to Sadia HaGaon. And then I'll check with Rabbi Levan and see how serious he is about actually achieving that goal. So I could decide what to do over the next 2 weeks. Okay, so I'm going to start with the very fastest of reviews, and I gave you lots of vocabulary words here, because this time period from the ending of the Talmud until Rabbi Sadia Gaon, it's pretty short, but a lot happens here.
Can you talk about years?
Yeah. Yeah, so the end of the Talmud is about 550, and Sadia Gaon, oh, I wish I had his death date here, but I don't. It's about 900-ish. So approximately that period of time. So this is the period of the Gaonim, so that's why I'm starting right here. Tanaim, Amoraim, Savoraim, and Gaonim. So the im is plural in each case. So a Tana being singular. The Tanaim wrote the Mishnah. So that's approximately 0 to 250. The Amoraim, or Enamora, one person is an Amora, they wrote the Talmud. The Savoraim, a Savora, that's a very short period of time. As you can see, it's only 125 years. Oh, you can't see that because it's on my notes. I have the extra notes. It's 125 years, so that's a very short period of time, and it's a transitional period of time. Many people feel that they don't necessarily have their own specific contribution, which is why I was going to skip them, but they are listed in the progression of leaders and names of leaders, so I thought I'll put them in. But their it seems like their main contribution was possibly re-editing and smoothening the Talmud. But this is all now Babylonian Jewry. That's where the center of Jewry is now in Babylonia. Remember that the centers of Judaism have been destroyed in the land of Israel. You basically have a remnant left over in Yavna. They're writing the Palestinian or the Jerusalem Talmud at the time. It's called both names.
Is this a Gaon?
During this entire period of time, we have the destruction going back to the year zero, basically, right? So that's the rise in Christianity, which we discussed, right? And the destruction of the temple, which is the year 70. So you have the rise in Christianity, the destruction of the temple, the destroying of the land of Israel, and then the realization of the sages that there's going to be a long and dark exile, which we're still in, 2,000 years. So with that understanding prophetically at that time, or it can't be prophetically because remember prophecy ended with the beginning of the Second Temple, but there still is today Holy Spirits, Ruach HaKodesh it's called, that we have. We even consider that we have it when we name our children. Our children get names, their Hebrew names are a little thread of Holy Spirit in us, that we prophetically bestow those names upon them for whatever reason. Their souls are best expressed through those names. But anyway, they did understand that we'd be in this long exile and that things would have to change. So one of the things that had to change was the oral law had to get written down. Right? So that's the Mishnah. The Mishnah was written down as a mnemonic device in shorthand, wasn't enough to keep it going. So that's why the Gemara expounds upon it. The Talmud expounds upon it. So technically it's the Mishnah is the mnemonic device. The Talmud is the whole thing altogether. The Gemara is the explanation on the Mishnah. And the Mishnah and the Gemara together is called the Talmud. We today use Talmud and Gemara interchangeably. Talmud being a Hebrew word, Gemara being an Aramaic word. The language spoken at this time by most of the Jews is Aramaic. So, and now they're in, now, fast forward past the times of the Gemara, which you did with Dr. Mashori. So now, fast forwarding past that, so they're in Babylon, in the centers of the cities there. The cities there are full, expansive Jewish life, and that's the home base for all Jewish life in the world is Babylon at that time. There are some communities starting to branch out, particularly in North Africa. There is a legend about how the Jews got leadership in North Africa. I'm not sure how they got to North Africa in the first place. By trade. You know, Jews spread out around the world by trade routes. So North Africa was a significant community without leadership. The legend, I'm trying to remember if I told you this last time, because I seem to remember saying it in a class, but whatever, if I'm repeating myself. So the it turns out that today, as it was at that time, Jewish institutions never have enough money. And so they would send people out to raise money for their institutions. So from Bavel, the seat of Jewish institutions and all the yeshivas that were there, they would send often the heads of the institutions, because who's better to ask than the Rosh Yeshiva? You know, you can't turn down Rabbi Wasserman Sr., you know, but you could turn down me, right? So if Rabbi Wasserman Sr. comes and says, look, for the yeshiva, I got to have, you know, so you're going to give him, right? So they'd send the heads of the institutions out, right? So pirates captured the ship with four heads of yeshiva, and they were ransomed. Typically, they didn't know who they got, those pirates, because typically they knew Jews ransom Jews. They'll pay for Jews. So you just bring catch Jews on a boat, bring them to a port, they'll pay. So they brought these Jews to the port in North Africa. The North African Jews realized who those Jews were and said, we'll ransom you, but once we buy you, you're ours. We need leaders. You have to stay here. So they made the agreement and they stayed there, and that's how Torah leadership came to North Africa. But meanwhile, so in the period, that was probably after the Sevarim, after 625. So the next time period that's significant is the period of the Gaonim. Gaon means genius.
It means what?
Genius. A Gaon is a genius. So you've probably heard of the Vilna Gaon, yeah. Right? And we say Gaon instead of Gaon, but it's really two syllables, Gaon. But we just slur it together, Gaon, the Vilna Gaon. He's called the Vilna Gaon. He's late 1700s. He's called the Vilna Gaon because he was such a genius that he's from a different generation. So he's given the title of 1,000 years earlier, basically, because he belonged in that era in terms of his brilliance. But he doesn't actually live in that era. So that's quite a title to give him. It's not usually done. So anyway, this period of the Gaonim is an important period, and this is the period in which the Islam arises. So let's just set the stage. Okay, you've got the Jews speaking Aramaic in Babylon. So that's Iraq, right? Yeah, mm-hmm. Iraq. I always mix up Iran and Iraq. They're in Iraq. And you have basically all the Arabs are animists, pagans, idol worshippers of various kinds. They have a holy site in the city of Mecca, with the Kaaba, a meteorite. It's about three stories high, a huge black meteorite that crashed into the earth, who knows when, but they venerate it in their pagan worship, the Kaaba stone. Okay, so that exists, but most of the Arab tribes are pagan tribes at the time. However, because, you know, the way stories are told at that time by storytellers and by travelers, and because the Jews are travelers, because they're merchants, so Jewish stories fan out through the world. So the concept, and that's why Israel is placed, we talked about that before too, why Israel is in that special place. It's just a tiny sliver of land. But the whole job of the Jew is to get the message of one God out into the world. Right? So that's why we're placed at the crux of three continents and an ocean. So that through trade, our ideas can be spread to the entire world. Meanwhile, we're plucked out of that place, placed into Babylon, but still Jews are traders and they're spreading their stories slowly as people pass through them and as they pass through other peoples. So that's happening. Okay, so now you have somewhere in the city around the vicinity of Mecca, you have Muhammad is born. He's born in 570. Pretty sure, yeah. He's born in 5...
CE.
So we are CE now. We are after the destruction of the temple, after the rise of Christianity. So Christianity is already an active religion. It's already passed the Council of Nicaea in 325, I think that is approximately, early 300s. So it's already crystallized as a religion. They've already dealt with a lot of their theological issues. They've already come up with the doctrine of the Trinity, the virgin birth, and all kinds of other things, incorporating bits, threads of pagan ideology into Christianity, which is what the virgin birth is, and the doctrine of the Trinity, and all that is different pagan strains. So they've already, and Son of God even is pagan.
But the Jews are still in Babylon.
The Jews are still in Babylon. But I'm saying, okay. So we now have a destroyed Palestine. So all of Palestine is laid to waste. And that's when it's called Palestine, when the Romans name it Palestine after the Philistines. So that's a shtach to the Jews. You think it's your land, you think it's Judah, you think it's Israel. It's not. It's Palestine, named after the Philistines who lived there before you. So the Romans name it Palestine. The current Palestinians, of course, are not descended from that group of people. But anyway, so they rename it. The Romans rename it in order to get the Jews. Meanwhile, the Jewish center has moved over to Babylon. Christianity is dominant. It's the Byzantine era now. All right, so the Byzantines are taking over. They took over the Holy Land. I think they probably by then already had built the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is a beautiful edifice, large, tall, looks down upon the Har HaBayit, down upon the Temple Mount, where the temple was, in order to say, we're on top of you, right? So we won, you're destroyed, we're now physically higher than you. That was a thing at the time, being physically higher, as we'll see. So the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was physically higher than the Temple Mount in order to make that statement. Okay, so now we have Muhammad being born. He's a nobody, basically. He's a shepherd and a trader, and not particularly successful at anything. But somehow, the Rambam, Maimonides, later on, in his writings, he calls him Hamishuga, the Mishugana. Muhammad the Mishugana, that's what he's called.
By whom?
The Rambam, Maimonides. Pretty smart guy. He wrote in Arabic, understood the culture. So he calls him, and he's much later than him. He's like 500 years later than Muhammad, but still, he sees him as technically, mentally insane. But that notwithstanding, he does at some point go into a cave in the desert at about 610, so at age 40. He goes into a cave in the desert and has revelations where he believes that the angel Gabriel talks to him and tells him that it's his job, it's his mission to make monotheists out of the Arabs. So that's what he goes. He goes back into Mecca, Mecca being a pilgrimage city like it is today. It's important to understand that one flip that happened there. I'm not sure how Muhammad let that happen, but he wasn't Jewish, so I guess he did, but you'll see what I mean. So at the time, the commerce of the city was largely supported by all the pilgrims that came into the Kaaba stone. So everybody's selling their tchotchkes for coming on the pilgrimage and selling their all the needs that people have when they come on pilgrimage. That's the city. It's a tourist trap, really. It's a pilgrimage site, Mecca. He's in Mecca, and he says, time to be monotheistic. And all the merchants and everybody who runs the city says, I don't think so. That's a threat to us and our business. We're not interested in monotheism. We like the polytheistic trade that we get. Thank you very much. So he works hard on trying to convince people about monotheism, and they had heard some Bible stories through trade, but they were not interested in being monotheists at the time. So after about 10 years' work, he's only got 40 followers, and there's an assassination plot. He becomes more dangerous, assassination plot, and he's driven out of Mecca. So out of Mecca he goes, and he goes to the city Yatrib. Yatrib is now called Medina, or Medina, depending on how you pronounce it. So that's the Hebrew word you've probably heard of, Medinat Yisrael, right? The Medina, the state of Israel. When it was Yatrib, it was a largely Jewish city, mostly Jewish city. Today's Jews aren't allowed there. But it was a mostly Jewish city, and so he went there because the Jews were going to hear the message of monotheism, because they already heard the message of monotheism. So he decided, he brought his, much like we talked about Peter and Paul and how they tried to shape the message of Christianity, first to feed the Jews, and then they realized it's not going to go Jewish, it's going to go Gentile. So he was a little bit different. First he tried to give it to the Gentiles, to the Arabs, and then he realized that's not going to go so well. Let me first get a qualitative mass, what I need to start the religion by getting some Jews involved, so people who are already monotheists. I'll try to arrange it so it's kind of Jewish friendly. Sabbath is on the Saturdays. There's purity laws. There's kosher laws. There's, you know, that no pork, and you have to ritually slaughter animals, and you have to wash hands and feet before you do certain things. And so he tried to mimic Jewish practice in a lot of these things. The Jews of Yatrib, how interested were they? Not, right? They were not interested in this at all. They have their law. They're not interested in his thing. But he starts to write. He's illiterate, but he has people take dictation for him. He starts to write his Quran. So he starts to write the Quran, and he includes at first things that are pro-Jewish because he wants to attract the Jews. But eventually, when he sees the Jews are not coming, he becomes like Martin Luther, not king, Martin Luther, right, and writes vehemently anti-Jewish stuff. So that's why in the Quran you can find positive and negative things about the Jews in the same book.
What was he often introduced to that was any different? Was it something expanding upon? Or
no.
It was just basically offering them what they already had?
Even less, actually. So you have to understand. So we Westerners, we Americans, have been raised to respect all faiths and see them all as equal. They're all paths to the same destination. All the books are holy, and we should respect them. So I was certainly raised that way, but have learned enough to now understand that it's not true. That's just our Western American, particularly, vision. So the Quran, I'll say it on recording, just don't play it for Muslims, please, it's not holy. It's not. It's not a revelation by God. It's nothing like the Torah, which was revealed by God to the Jews at Mount Sinai. It's not the same at all. And neither is the New Testament. These are religions started by people much like Joseph Smith. It's much easier for us to look at Joseph Smith and say, he was a nut. You know, and he was. And if you read the Book of Mormon, it's crazy. It is crazy. So, and he tries to make it, he was also illiterate. He tries to make it sound biblical and flowery, but his stuff is nuts if you read it in there. It's fascinating to read. So it's easy for us to look at that and say, the guy was crazy. How did he create a sect? Something that's still busy today. And it's, I just read a book, it was called, interesting, called Leaving the Saints and Finding My Faith by Martha Beck, who's an Oprah doll. Martha Beck herself, but she was raised, she went to Harvard, she got her doctorate, had a Down syndrome child, so that wasn't so cool in the Harvard milieu, so she moved with her Down syndrome child back to Utah, where it was okay to have a Down syndrome child, but then tried to finish her doctorate there and do research in Brigham Young, which everything was censored, and so the first book about conceiving and keeping the Down syndrome child expecting Adam, worth the read, very good book. Second book, only if you're into pain of background and history, Leaving the Saints, Finding My Faith, is about Mormonism and the cult aspect and the cutting off of communication, the censorship in Brigham Young, the censorship in the library, the tapping the phones, the control of the church on what people teach, on what people think, on how people are treated in psychiatrist's office, on the drugs that are given. It's amazing to see. So that's clearly a cult, right? So what is Muhammad offering? Nothing except himself. He's a megalomaniac. So he truly, truly feels that what he has to offer is the best because he's nuts. Like Joseph Smith. He was all about himself. He's a prophet of God. So as a prophet of God, he could preach, you know, fidelity. Nobody should sleep around and commit adultery except the prophet of God. You know, it's good for any wife of any husband to sleep with a prophet of God because she's elevated spiritually thereby. So if you're a megalomaniac, so you can say whatever you want. So that's what he was offering. Nothing. Which is why the Jews were not following. Which is why he got angry. However, I think the Muslims at the time were ready for a message of monotheism. And so he did, within a pretty short period of time of coming to Yatrib, actually manage to convert most of the city to his monotheistic vision, and he worked out his doctrine at that time. The city then changed the name from Yatrib to Medinat HaNabe, which is the city of the prophet. Navi is prophet in Hebrew. Nabe, the prophet in Arabic. So it's the city of the prophet. Now it's just called Medina. So so that's the second holiest Muslim site, does that say, with Mecca being the first. Once he got Medina, he raised an army of 10,000 men and marched on Mecca because he wanted that Kaaba stone. And he used the Kaaba and the central value that the Kaaba had to the people in the region to gain converts by saying, actually, this stone is where Abraham did his sacrifice of his son. Which son? Ishmael. Right? So he...
rewrote history.
Yeah, he rewrote history. But excuse me, what's important to understand is that both the Christians and the Muslims are taking their legitimacy from the Jews. Because he wasn't just making up his own religion out of whole cloth. He had to attach it to something that people at the time knew was true. Abraham was a great man. Abraham founded a people that received the message of God. Right? Everybody knew that was true and everybody agreed with that. So then the Christians just took that forward and said the people who got that message from God dropped the ball. And so we now pick it up, and we're the new Israel, the Christians. We move forward. That's our job. And the Muslims said the same thing. Abraham, man of God, relationship with God, founded a people through his child, Ishmael. And it's their job to bring the monotheistic message forward. The Jews, who got an initial message, actually lost that message. Not that they dropped the ball. They completely fumbled it. They lost it altogether. So what they call the Torah, because there's clearly discrepancies between the Torah and the Quran, right? So how does he resolve that? The Jews blew it. They lost it, and they reconstructed it incorrectly. The Quran, so therefore, God had to re-reveal what he revealed in the first place at Sinai to the Jews. He now re-gave to Muhammad in the body of the Quran. So that's what the Quran is, according to Muslims, the actual true revelation. So it's not an additional book. It's the actual true book given to the Muslims, given to the Jews, but they lost it, now re-revealed to the responsible people who will keep track of it finally at this point.
Have you ever read the Quran? I never have. Uh-huh. Is it similar?
Parts of it. I've only read parts of it. It's not similar in that there's not a storyline. I haven't read enough because it's not interesting to me. The Book of Mormon, I never read, but my husband read me parts of it because he read the whole thing cover to cover. So that has more of a storyline. But the Quran doesn't so much. It's in chunks. So that's why one of the things I put in here was surah, just for vocabulary words. Surah is the name of a book in the Quran. So when it talks about a surah, it'll say the fifth surah, the 26th verse, or whatever. So the surahs are the books. And there's, I'm not sure how many surahs there are. But that's just so you know that vocabulary word. And then the sharia and hadith. Sharia is their word for halacha. Right? So sharia law would be their legal law. So similar to Judaism, but not Jewish. So in this case, we say lahavdil, which means to differentiate between Judaism and them, but still there's a similarity. Similar to Judaism, you can't really differentiate between temporal life and spiritual life. Right? So, for instance, when we do business, we are spiritually obligated to separate 10% from our earnings, to do business honestly, to not do business unfairly, even if it's honest, but we can't make an unfair profit on something. Right, we're not supposed to open up a store too close to somebody else's to compete with them unfairly. There's all kinds of laws about business that are spiritual laws that affect our business life. And the same thing for everything else. How we're neighborly. Like, let's say we own a field and we want to sell it now. We have to ask the next door neighbor to that field for first rights of refusal because that's the right thing to do. Ask your neighbor if they want it before you. But that's a law. So how do you separate spiritual law from temporal law? It's not so easy. So same thing with Islam. One of the contributions of America is that separation of church and state, right? Trying to detangle those two things so that the church wouldn't rule on matters of the state and the state wouldn't have what to say in matters of the church. But they certainly are intertwined in Judaism and also in Islam. So that's Sharia. And the Hadith is their oral tradition. So they do have the Quran, the written word, and then they have an oral interpretation that goes along with it, and that's the Hadith. And I believe that's also written in places. I don't know what that would be called, but there is an oral tradition that goes along with it to explain it. So the Quran, again, it doesn't have much storyline, and a lot of it is contradictory. So, for instance, they say Miriam is the mother. They mix up Miriam, sister of Moses, with Mary, mother of Jesus, in the same person. So calling that person Miriam and just conflating those two together. So it is written by somebody who heard stories but hadn't learned Torah, hadn't even read the Torah, let alone learned it, so that he didn't fully get it, but he pulled stories. So clearly it's pulling legitimacy from what people at the time understood to be legitimate monotheism to try to create an Arabic monotheism.
I was just wondering if it was the same in terms of the sophistication and the way it lays out process for life, like you talked about earlier, versus just a document that really does seem like it's someone just remembering this.
So from what I've read, and I've read more about than actually read it itself, but I have read quite a bit about. No, it's not that way at all. doesn't have that at all. I'm sure there would be Muslim scholars who would argue that, but I'm just going to speak from a completely ethnocentric point of view. There's plenty of Latter-day Saints scholars who will argue that too, right? So I would just use that as the parable to understand. If you look at the Book of Mormon, and if you understand what they did, I mean, even their Book of Abraham, I don't know if you're familiar with that whole story in Mormonism, but apparently Joseph Smith found the Books of Mormon. They were written in ancient Egyptian. He was able to translate them because when he found the golden plates that were written in those ancient Egyptian, in that...
Found them under a rock.
He found them under a rock with a translating seeing stone. So he was able to put the seeing stone into his hat and then look into his hat and on the other side of a sheet from the person who took dictation...
Buy the sheet.
Yeah, I know.
What'd you say?
How do people buy this ridiculous stuff? On the other side of the curtain, somebody took dictation of the whole thing. After the dictation was taken, there's a South Park episode that's worth watching that will explain some of this history, but it actually is pretty accurate. I don't know, I have teenagers, so occasionally I do watch that stuff. Anyway, and there's a whole thing about how the wife of the person who took the dictation hid the first 70 pages and said, if it's really true, go back and retranslate it. So, of course, he couldn't retranslate it because he was just making it up as he was going along. So when he went back to him and said, my wife stole those 70 pages, he said, all right, I'm going to have to talk to God about this. Turns out God is very angry and didn't mean for those pages to ever come to public light anyway. So we'll just start from where we left off and go forward with that. Okay, but meanwhile then, after you translate, that's the Book of Mormon. Now the Book of Abraham, which is after that, is when a Irish charlatan is traveling through, and at the time of the reading of the tombs in Egypt, then they sold the ancient artifacts before they were protected, right? So this is in the 1800s. A papyrus, however you pronounce it, scroll was brought there, and Joseph Smith saw it, bought it, and said, this is the Book of Abraham. It's an addition to our scripture, and he translated the whole thing. And all about Abraham and how the Mormons are right and how Jesus first came to America before he was crucified and taught the American Indians, all kinds of stuff. Anyway, so then he died. His wife sold that scroll to the Chicago Museum of Science. Chicago Museum of Science goes up in a fire, and the document is destroyed. Except it wasn't, because it was on loan to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. So in the 1960s, somebody discovered it because of the diagrams that were in it that matched the translation and saw that that's the actual Book of Abraham that he translated. And since he translated, the Rosetta Stone was found and unlocked the key to translating all the hieroglyphs. So now they're able to see that this Book of Abraham was, in fact, a typical funerary scroll that's just buried with dead people and had nothing at all to do with Abraham, right? So, and still, they buy it. Still, they do. Still, they have apologists who explain how that all worked together.
But aren't there people out there who could make some of these arguments about Torah or about those kinds of things?
So what's fascinating, one of the gifts in my life that's helping me grow is a son who doesn't actually believe in Judaism right now. So, so my 16-year-old... yeah. So my 16-year-old is also a computer genius. Literally. And spends hours in his computer tinkering and Linuxing and talking to people all around the world about how to make programs and everything. But occasionally on his spare time, he will watch those type of South Park episodes, plus search the web for anything atheistic he can find to fight with me about, right? So he's got tons of anti-Christian atheistic stuff, but nothing anti-Jewish. You can't find it. All the screeds, all the like the angry stuff, you'll find anti-Mormon stuff and anti-Christian stuff and anti-Catholic stuff, but you can't find those kinds of videos anti-Jewish. So you will find those kinds of videos made by Christians anti-Old Testament because they're coming from a Christian point of view. So they'll use Old Testament scripture, what they call Old Testament, and find passages, let's say like an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, which everybody here in this room knows is monetary and that we never take things literally. We have an oral law that goes with it. You can't understand anything literally. We know that for a fact, and that's how we've always behaved. However, Christians haven't always behaved that way. So they'll look at that scripture and say, oh, the Jews are just as violent in their scriptures as the Muslims are in theirs. But, again, to quote the Christians, If you will say, by your fruits shall you know them, by their fruits shall you know them. So if you look at the Muslims, if you look at the Christians, and you look at the Jews, and look at their scriptures, and then see who's violent and who's not violent, in general, throughout history, there's huge differences. Huge. So you can't find that stuff really anti-Jewish. Look! And he has. Right? So it is a gift. I hope he grows out of the stage. I'm trying to hold him in it lovingly. And it does provide me with challenges and lots of additional information. So I know that there's nothing. There are sites of Jews who are disgusted with Jews.
Or non-Jews who are.
Oh, yeah. For sure non-Jews. I'm talking about internal Jewish stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Like there is the Mormon stuff of stories of Mormons who have come out, Mormons who have been, who have understood that it's a cult, things like that. But there's nothing like that against Judaism. I mean, there may be an individual here or there, but there's not a body, there's not a group. There's nothing to say that Judaism is harmful, it cuts you off, creates bad communities, creates bad families, creates pathology within people, as pathological as we might be. It's not Judaism, it's the history that we lived through, right? Did I ever tell you the difference between a Jewish optimist and Jewish pessimist? So a Jewish pessimist says, it can't get worse than this. And the Jewish optimist says, yes, it can! Right. So that's not Judaism. That's just Jews, right? So we have our pathology, and that's why there's Jews who are frustrated with Jews because of the pathologies of Jews, but not of Judaism. You can't hang it on, really, on Jewish law. Not that we're not encumbered, not that it's not a heavy burden sometimes, not the 3 times a day prayer and all that kind of stuff, and kitniot, and you can list a whole bunch of things that we're waiting for Mashiach to come and sift through and say, actually, you don't need this, you do need this, this is a diet, right? We still have to keep it all until he does that. But it's not that we're not encumbered. We are. And yet, none of it is harmful in its essence to us, whereas in Islam, it is harmful in its essence to people. Look what's happening in the Muslim world. People who live under Islam with Islamic law, it does not empower them. It hurts them. It hinders them. It hinders their growth individually, as family members, as society members, as world members. They're a mess. And not only are they a mess inside themselves, but they hurt other people because of the mess that they are from their religion. And Jews are the opposite.
But aren't there biblical scholars or people who study and say, like, this is all man, you know, written by man versus written by God? Like, there are people who have different, you know.
Biblical criticism.
Right. That's kind of what I'm saying. Like, that's on Judaism, too, not just on.
So the biblical critics, that was basically, it's interesting to see, that was in the 1800s. Bless you. I don't know a ton about it, but I know that they first took apart the Old Testament, and then they took apart the New Testament, and they compared different things and created their different authors, the different styles that they have, and all that kind of stuff, and made their whole theory about that. They wanted to do it to the Quran, too. And so they sent out a bunch of people in the late 1800s to take pictures of the different versions of the Quran in the different places around the world. And then a mysterious accident happened, and the professor who was directing that died mysteriously. Fortunately, the films were kept, and so passed on to his top graduate students. And there was a mountain accident. But the films were kept and passed on to his top student. And I think then there was the Second World War when that student said that it was all destroyed in the fire. But it wasn't. And they just found it about 6 years ago. But now it's also still too dangerous a time period to make it all public. However, with computers now, you can make it all public, just like the Dead Sea Scrolls.
WikiLeaks.
Right. So now you can finally...
WikiLeaks.
Now you can finally make it public and put it in enough hands that it can't endanger a single person. But I don't know if that's happened yet, or if if now it's too tight an environment to do that.
What specifically is it?
The Quran, the different versions of the Quran. Mm-hmm. See, when they did it for the Torah, there weren't different versions. You can't find different versions. All the versions all around the world are all the same.
Just whether you believe God wrote it or not.
Right. People can still argue with the right. So you can. I think that Right, so that would be scientific arguments against it. It's interesting if you read where Hirsch took that attitude, because he writes in the 1840s during the time of biblical criticism, to take a scientific attitude and look at the Torah from an internal Torah perspective. How do you understand words based on how they're used in other places? And so that's his whole commentary is based on that, not based on the heresy of it, but based on the internal arguments of it. That he's writing as opposed to those scholars at the time. But those scholars at the time are writing with an agenda, which is to disprove God and to not have to be obligated to God. That comes from the Christian paradigm. And it's very important to understand that. That's one reason why we're learning. Why should we be talking so much about the rise of Islam in the Jewish history class or the rise of Christianity in the Jewish history class? Because you have to understand the trends that are happening in the world and how they impact on Judaism. So you have to understand the trend of Christianity and its hold, the church and state blend, and the church's hold on science and state and development of science and knowledge and the spread of knowledge and their desire to hold that back in order to maintain their control. So church and science became enemies. So people just translated that into religion and science. But Judaism and science are not enemies. That doesn't mean that there aren't some Jews who have bought that Christian line. And some even scholarly Jews who have mistakenly bought into religion and science don't go together. But it's Christianity and science that don't go together. Judaism does go with it. So, but at that point, especially since the Christians took the Jewish scriptures into their scriptures, so then Christianity encompassed the Jewish scriptures, so then they had to be disproven in order to shake the tyranny of the church. So that made Judaism a casualty for a lot of people and Jewish scriptures. But so yes, you could do that from a scholarly point of view, but you have to understand the agenda of those scholars. So it's a small, large, today it's grown into, you know, that's the main scholarly world, to disprove God and to not need to so that you won't have the obligation of following anything or doing anything. It's a lot of work to be a Jew. No question about it, right? You definitely are burdened by it. But I think in this class I mentioned this, it was a fascinating thing when I went to Mexico. My daughter went to Mexico, and then I went and saw too. We see now how Mexico is falling apart because they don't have the rule of law. They have laws in the books that they can't enforce, right? Or you see what Saudi Arabia is like because their law rules so harshly. In both countries, women can't go out so easily unprotected. One, because law is so harsh, a woman can't go without the permission of her husband or father. She's not allowed to go unaccompanied by a male. And in Mexico, it's dangerous for her to go because their law doesn't rule, right? So law frees. In this country, we have laws. We can all count on the fact that everybody will follow the rules. Basically, at a red light, other people will stop. So we know we can go. We don't double check before we go through a green light because we count on people to follow the laws, basically. We do. In general, in this country, and it's just in general, it's not perfect, but in general, we are freed by everybody's adherence to the law. We know that we're basically pretty safe. We basically can count on our government structure. We don't have to smear everybody. There's not tips as it was in the Arab culture, as it is in Mexican culture, as it is in Russian culture, where you have to tip everybody for legal and illegal things. For legal things, you can't buy a postage stamp without giving a tip to the guy to sell it to you. Right? So that's not the way it is in this country, because law frees. So, but if you're in the church-dominated law, where law encumbers rather than frees, so you'd want to try to figure out how you can pick apart scripture to take people out of the necessity to relate to it and be encumbered by its laws. Does that make sense? So it's really coming from a Christian paradigm. It's not a Jewish thing. And the more you learn Torah, the more you learn how perfect it is. And those guys didn't learn it. They did their biblical criticism coming from Christianity. So coming from the Christian relationship to Scripture, which is very different than the Jewish relationship to Scripture, how you study it. So even if a Jew will go to a Christian and say, I thought the Messiah, the Jewish Messiah, is supposed to be descended from the house of David. Descent from houses goes to the father line. Patrilineal descent it's matrilineal for Judaism, but patrilineal for which house you're a part of, right? So if you're supposed to be house of David, and Jesus is house of David, and God is his father, so how is he house of David? How does that work? Right? So you can't ask a Christian that question because they don't look at Scripture like we do. They'll say that that's not it. Joseph was appointed to be his father. He was the house of David, even though he wasn't biologically his father. Like that, they're not worried about truth. We are. So it's a totally different paradigm from which we approach text. So if you're coming from a Christian paradigm and approaching Jewish text that way, then you can tear it apart that way. But if you look at it differently, then you can't. As you're seeing through this, through Rabbi Levin's class and through other things, but you do have to learn a lot. We're very far from understanding all of that. And I'm pointing all of us, even the rabbis of Jewish experience, I mean, we're all so far from understanding all of this stuff that a lot of it's just relying on tradition. Okay. I can ask more questions, but let's get back to Rise of Islam. Okay, so Rise of Islam, so it happens, so there's five basic pillars for Islam, which basically do come from Judaism, but they're all tweaks on it. So the first pillar is belief in one God and Muhammad as his final prophet. So God and prophecy, they believe in, just they draw a different line at where the end of prophecy is. The Muslims incorporate the Jewish prophets and the Christian prophets. So Jesus is considered an important prophet to the Muslims, and the final prophet being Muhammad. So that's the first pillar of Islam. The second pillar is fasting, purification and learning self-restraint through fasting.
And he wrote that he was the final prophet.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's one of the pillars of Islam. He is the final prophet. He's bringing the final tikkun, basically, to world religions in re-revealing the Quran. Fasting. Every year, the entire month of Ramadan. Now, the Muslims have a lunar calendar. We Jews have a lunisolar calendar. Americans have a solar calendar. Right, so our calendar, the lunar calendar, is trued, our Jewish calendar is trued by the solar calendar, which is why, for instance, this year we have a leap month, double Adar, because seven times in 19 years, we have an extra month in order to true our calendar to the solar calendar, so the Passover will always be in the spring. That's not the case with the Muslims. They adopted the solar calendar, the lunar calendar, like the Jews have, but they didn't true it to the solar calendar, so Ramadan moves around the year. So, but during that month, they fast every day, a half-day fast from sunup to sundown. No food, no drink, they can't even swallow their spit, and no marital relations. Just during the day. And then at night, big parties and anti-Semitic television shows. That's the entertainment. Yeah, big parties. And then that is what, it's a big party month, so it's fasting during the day, and then family time every night. Family and friend time, people get together to break the fast. And when they put out the anti-Semitic television series, they do it during Ramadan because that's when the most people are together and then want to watch something faith-strengthening.
Why can't they swallow their spit?
Because it's drinking.
Right. So they spend the day spitting?
Yeah. Well, I think you get pretty dry after a while. It's a desert, you know. I don't think there's a lot of spit to swallow, but you're not allowed to swallow it.
I think there's... I lived in Asia. There's a lot of spitting going on anyway. And it's not like Yom Kippur, where when you end sort of a soft ending, and you go from prayer to sort of a breaking fast ceremony and everything else. The Muslims will actually sit around a table listening to their prayers from the minarets, and as soon as they're done, they start eating. So it's not entirely religiously observant.
Right.
It's really something I got to do.
Right. Which I'm sure in many religions there's things like that. But, yeah. Okay, so that's one of them, fasting. Charity. Every Muslim has to count their own charity. It's called zakat. Sounds like tzedakah. But that's what it's called, zakat. And it's 2.5% of their holdings every year, not counting like capital stuff. Let's see, what does it say? 40th of one's capital, excluding such items as primary residence, car, and professional tools. So every year, 2.5%.
Well, that would have helped the country of Egypt out if Mubarak had stuck to that.
It's 40 billion.
Where does it go? I mean, there's no unified place. It's not like you're sending it to the Vatican. So where does the 2.5 go?
Right, it's a good question. It's a good question because Muhammad did initially take up the Jewish line of social responsibility. That's one of the Jewish gifts to the world, is that we are responsible for each other. And so he did teach caring for one another and giving charity to the poor and taking care of orphans and women in a way that was different than what was going on at the time. So in that sense, Islam is better for the underprivileged than the pagan societies at the time were. However, so where does it go? However, look, by their fruits shall you know them. Look at the Muslim world. What institutes of charity do they have?
So where's the money going?
I don't know.
The money's obviously not going to go.
So is it not kept? Is it not organized? Is it all stolen? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But I know that that's one of the pillars of the faith. And do they give it to others? They don't. You never see the Muhammad Hospital. Like, we don't have one of those in Manhattan. You have Maimonides Hospital in Mount Sinai and Beth Israel. And where's Muhammad Hospital? Right? And there's a thousand times or 10,000 times? Oh. I don't know my zeros and how to calculate them properly. There's 14 million Jews and 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. You calculate what that means in terms of times the amount and see how many charitable institutions there are that reach out to others or even reach out to themselves. You know, I mean, it always bothered me when they say it's so terrible, the Israelis, they don't let the Gazans pass the checkpoints to get to Hadassah Hospital. They need that medical thing. I'm thinking, really? We build Hadassah Hospital on our tzedakah dollars. You know, you got 1.6 billion Muslims on the planet. Build a Hadassah Hospital in Gaza City. You know, like, where are your charitable institutions? Where's your cutting-edge technology? How come you have to come to our hospital? We will treat you for free, as we do, if you can make it bomb three through the free through the checkpoint. But, you know, anyway, I don't see it. I don't see it.
I think you told us, but I can't remember. Was Muhammad Jewish?
No, he was not.
So
he was not.
How did he get his basic
line? He was a Hashemite. The Saudi Arabian kingdom is still a Hashemite kingdom. So he's from one of the prominent tribes. Where did he get his learning? Through storytelling. I mean, that was, don't forget, in a time before YouTube and television and radio and books. So most of the stories were oral stories. And the stories of the Torah were interesting, good stories. So they're told by people. And there were storytellers that went from place to place. They would tell moral stories, you know, morality tales, and they would bring the news also. I mean, imagine, I'm following the Egyptian news today, and I was looking forward to getting up in the morning to reading the paper. I said to my husband, like, I wonder what happened in Egypt overnight. And then I thought, why should I even bother wondering? I'm going to read the New York Times. It's 15 hours old. Like, what kind of news is that, 15 hours old? You know, and I was thinking, oh, my gosh, our standards of news are so different. I don't want to read 15-hour-old news. I'll just go online and see what's happening right now. Right? But it wasn't that way then at all. Like, a two-month-old news was, wow, you have something new to tell us about what's going on in wherever, because you've walked from there to here, tell us the news, right? That's how stories traveled. So, and Bible stories, too, traveled that way. Especially because a lot of them had morals. Let's see. So that's the fourth pillar. The fifth one is Hajj. Did I tell you all five? Yeah, I got them out of order for you. But Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca. So once he raised his army of 10,000 people and he goes over to Mecca to capture the city, he does manage to capture it, purifies the Kaaba stone, and then teaches that the Kaaba stone, and I'm not exactly sure, because what I read was the Kaaba stone is where Abraham offered his son Ishmael to God, rather than where he was commanded to offer his son. So I'm not quite sure if it was a personal offering, like, is that how it's taught in the Quran? Or is it just the same story where God said, offer your son, your one, your only one, and the one, only one happened to be Ishmael, not Isaac.
Is that stone still hanging around?
Where did that story come from? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay. The stone is still there. That's the Kaaba stone that's in the center of Mecca.
Okay.
That is the main stone, and so Mecca is still a city of pilgrimage today. It's the largest religious pilgrimage on the planet. Over 2 million people a year go to Mecca, and then there's a specific route. You circle the Kaaba stone. You have to wear special clothes, so that's where it's still a place of, you know, economic prosperity from even just the pilgrimage. People have to have a place to stay. People have to have food to eat. People have to have bathrooms to use. People have to have clothes to wear. People have to have souvenirs to bring home, right? So still it's a place where people converge once a year. It's a specific time of the year. Excuse me. And then There's a route that you go that reminds you of the route that Abraham took in sacrificing his son Ishmael on the Kaaba stone.
But did he?
No.
Well, I've never heard that story.
That's the Quran story. So the Jewish story is Abraham sacrificed his son, almost, right? God commanded him to sacrifice his son, Isaac. So what I'm saying is that the Muslims, they took that story. That's an important story. That Abraham, their father, that they recognized, and they are descendants of Ishmael. Abraham, their father, was in such a strong relationship with God that he was willing to sacrifice his own child to God. That's an important foundational story. So they just took that story and made it Muslim from Jewish. So instead of it being the son Isaac, it was the son Ishmael, which makes them the descendants of Ishmael, the important ones in the world, not the descendants of Isaac. So still Abraham.
Is it the same story of then, you know, not sacrificing Ishmael after all?
I think so, but I don't know for sure. It's a good question. Yeah.
I wonder if there's a place where you can go and, like, actually take some sort of class or have discussions where there is, like, a...
Comparative religion classes at DU.
Yeah, but...
Yeah, except for everybody has their own agenda.
Right.
You know? So I think the thing to do is listen to a... You want to learn from the people who believe what they're saying. And then make your own decisions.
Yeah.
So I think you should learn Judaism from Jews and learn what the Muslims have to say from a Muslim. Learn what the Mormons have to say from a Mormon. I'll tell you what I think about Mormonism. It's very different than what the missionary kid's going to knock on your door and tell you. You know, they do 2 years of mission.
Mm-hmm.
So invite one in someday. You see to what they look like, Yeshiva Bachram, without a yarmulke on and a backpack on their bike.
Yeah.
Say, hey, I'm curious. Come tell me. And they'll tell you all about it. Yeah, it'd be fascinating to hear from them. Why did they choose this mission? How did they get put together? What did they learn to prepare for it? Who was Joseph Smith? What did he bring to the world? How does that add to Christian canon? Blah, 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 blah. Mormons are fascinating people. Everybody's going to have their own planet. But that's why it's important to have plural marriages, because you need to populate your planet. So every man will be a god over his own planet and solar system. And the more wives he has, the more population he'll have on his planet when he dies. Yeah.
Yeah, and every woman has to have a secret name.
Just.
Because the guy will then call you.
Oh, yeah.
And you name. Don't know your secret name.
How are you going to answer?
Yeah.
Elliot, you're freaking me out right now. That's just freaking me out.
Okay, we didn't get far enough. You can't go yet. Okay.
I got to go get my kid.
You can go.
I got to get my kid.
Okay, no. Okay, so should
I'm
we just
sorry.
Continue next time? Okay,
yeah.
Fine. We'll do that.
I'm sorry.
You know, Muhammad had a lot of his revelations.
Just call me
after
Sherry, okay?
Water pipe?
Epileptic.
Throw water. Okay, there's your son.
Seizure.
To a day school. Now.
Fascinating.
To tell him it's very computer science is very aligned with the Torah, very top down logical.
It's cool that you are allowing him that space. I commend you for that.
I'm trying to stay in a loving relationship with him. And, yeah, it's not just allowing.
You don't have a choice. You're not. Yeah.
It's not a choice.
No.
So my choice is, how do I respond to him?
Right.
Not
right.
Who will he be?
Right.
God gave him free will too.
Yeah. Good for you, though, for being a good mom.
He'll come back.
Yeah.
I think it's part of his job.